In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for a throwback coolest conversations in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and today we feature an older coolest conversations. My interview with Jerry Rosley, keyboard player and lead singer of the Sonics, that originally aired May the 1st, 2015. The band is from Tacoma, Washington, and in the 60s, they issued a number of singles and three studio albums. Their raw, primitive garage rock sounds have since become legendary, and notable fans include the likes of Robert Plant, Bruce Springsteen, and Jack White. In 2015, they issued their first album of new material since reforming, titled This Is the Sonics, and it features our coolest song of the week, I Don't Need No Doctor. During our discussion, we talk about how Elvis inspired Jerry to play rock and roll, the formation of the Sonics, his departure, and their reforming, as well as the new album and the track, I Don't Need No Doctor. We'll hear some of that now first, followed by my chat with Jerry on your throwback coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I don't need no doctor.
You got the Mighty Manfred here, and what an honor and a pleasure to be speaking with Jerry Rosley of the Sonics, the Mighty Sonics, today on your coolest conversations. Hey, Jerry, how are you?
Pretty good. Feeling pretty good.
Well, on those early recordings of yours, like The Witch and Strychnine, He's Waiting, and even on that new single, Bad Betty, you were just wailing like a man possessed. When were you first possessed by the rock and the roll?
Well, I would say I was first possessed around in the 50s in junior high school or middle school, whatever you want to call it. Then I was repossessed in 2007 when we reunited.
Well, was there a particular artist or a band that really hooked you into rock and roll music?
Yeah, back then it was Elvis Presley.
Oh, excellent. And when you play the keyboards, when did you start playing the keyboards, and what did your family think about you playing rock and roll?
They used to make me take accordion lessons, and I didn't like that. I mean, I thought it was okay because there was no rock and roll, so I had no big desire to play anything, really.
So then later on, my understanding is that Larry Parepa, he started the band about 1960, and they started off doing instrumentals, but you were playing with somebody else at that time. Is that right?
Yeah, I was playing a lot with, we were called the Searchers, and that had me and Rob Lind, our current sax player, and Bob Bennett, he was our drummer. And they're both good friends of mine, and the three of us hitched up with the two Sonics, and that's what it is.
And so Bob Bennett being the original drummer in the Sonics, well, I guess he wasn't the original if Larry had already started the band prior to that.
Well, they used to do, I think it was pretty much just instrumentals, quite a bit of instrumentals, and they didn't really record anything. But then when I got that Searchers and Sonics, then we started, that's when we first went in to record.
Were you the first singer in the Sonics?
No. There was a friend of mine. It was Ray Michelson, and he was in the Sonics, but I don't know if they just asked me if I knew anybody to sing lead. And I says no, and he says, well, why don't you try it? I says, heck, I can't sing, but I got to liking it, and couldn't quit.
Well, I'm glad you never have. So, were you? You guys must have been playing out as the, let's call it, the classic lineup. and you came to the Wailers' attention, where would you guys play? Would you play clubs or teen parties, or where would this early Sonics be gigging at?
Well, we played everywhere. The early Sonics, we played, like, they had a Crescent Ballroom. They had the Tacoma Armory. Any assortment of, well, no, I shouldn't say that. We didn't play taverns. We played at, they had a teenage nightclub at that time. It's called the Red Carpet. We played there from time to time. When The Witch came out, we started playing all over the place, all over the state.
What was the inspiration for The Witch?
Well, could be ex-wives, mother-in-laws, just about anything that gets on your nerves. And no, I'm just kidding.
Do you recall how old were you when The Witch came out?
Yeah, I think I was about 19 or so.
Wow, still pretty young. So over time, the band really didn't end as much as kind of players just kind of left. And I think Jim Brady eventually had the name. When did you leave the band, and why did you decide to leave?
Well, I left in 67, mostly because, even nowadays, the groups have a hard time getting along in a lot of cases. Somebody wants something and the other guys don't like it, and so then they kind of give each other the stink eye, and it gets worse. And I just kind of had it at the time with the whole thing.
When did you become aware of the Sonics' legacy? From Robert Plant to Jack White and lots of other artists regularly name-check the Sonics, talk about the brilliance of the band. When did you become aware of any of that?
Well, Fiery Brown, in the late 60s and early 70s, I'd have a person or two would tell me that they saw something in a magazine, or I did. You guys, your record's out in some place in New Orleans or something like that, you know. And I just kind of thought, yeah, right, sure we are. I thought I would never want to go back into music. Actually, I wanted to do something else, which I did, regular type stuff. And,
well, so why did you guys decide to reform in 2007? What, you hadn't reformed before that? I know that people had made offers for you guys to get back together, and you decided no. But in 2007, you decided to give it another shot. Was there any one particular thing that made you want to do it, or how did you come to making the decision?
Well, we kept being asked by this promoter in New York. He has what's called a Cave Stomp Festival.
Right.
And he just wouldn't take no for an answer. So he called us for, I don't know, about 2 or 3 years. Every year he'd call us, and he'd try and make it as tempting. It got more tempting each time he did it. So finally we said, I'll tell you what, we haven't played for 40 years, so give us a month or two to get an idea if we even should even go after this. And so we did practice, and we said, well, that's not too bad. Got a lot of rust, but we got rid of that. And so we went and played for them. It started everything all over again. Because New York, it's pretty big deal to play there. And then also we've heard that they could carve you up and throw you out in the dumpster if they didn't like you. So we were shaken.
You may have been shaken, but I know the people in the audience, they were doing a lot more shaking, a lot of dancing as well, weren't they?
Yeah, one thing, I we'd never been in a band. They were doing the jumping in and doing the mosh pit thing, and stage diving and fist pumping and all that stuff. And I thought, wow, this is great, because they were really excited,
So let me ask. So you'd never played in New York City before, obviously, right?
No.
That was it. So when you got together in the 60s, did you ever play outside of the Pacific Northwest?
Somewhat. We got called back to one time. We went back to Cleveland and Philadelphia, and that was a real quickie. I think we played two nights, and we were not the featured group. We just came in and played the intermission of some other group we never heard of. It was weird.
I feel sorry. I feel sorry for that group, because they play. They had the Sonics open for them, and they're not able to let anybody know about that.
you just never know what's going to happen.
So you did the New York show. That goes over really well. And did that convince you guys?
Friday night and a Sunday night.
And did that convince you to give it another shot?
It gave us confidence because the first night we were worried. You know, we were behind a curtain, and then they opened that thing up, and it blew my mind. I'm looking out there, and it was just like I'd quit in 67. It looked like the same people. You know, so young people looked like lots of teenagers and people in their 20s, all ages, but it just looked like the same bunch, you know. And I couldn't believe it. I think, whoa, what is this? 40 years later, and the crowd is the same or looks the same. But fortunately, they liked it, so that gave us confidence and to go back. You know, we felt better about going back Sunday because we knew it seemed to be going over pretty good.
Let me ask you then, since then, you've played all over the world. Uh-huh. Are the audience the same? Is it the same makeup? Is it primarily younger people, or what is the audience like?
Yeah, it is a lot of younger people, and that's a shock. It's been a shock to us. Mostly younger people, but a lot of them in their 20s, I would say, and we see people all the way up to senior citizen.
The current lineup that you've got also features Freddie Dennis on bass. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that he played with the Kingsmen and the Liverpool Five. Did you know Freddie back in the day?
I had met him when the Sonics were no longer a band. A couple of them were playing with Freddie in a place called the Red Roof Pub. It was kind of like a tavern in Tacoma, and I met him there.
Well, how did he wind up in the band, the current lineup?
Well, him and Larry had been doing some smaller things, just kind of a quirky group they throw together, you know, whenever they wanted to, you know. I don't think they ever recorded or were serious or anything like that. It was real loose. But we got Freddie because his voice, it fits with the group, you know.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100%. His voice is killer. I mean, he's not as distinctive as your own, but it's still very strong, very great.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a minute about the new album. This is the Sonics, produced by Jim Diamond. That was no Kearney Barton production, but I think it does your legacy proud. How do you think the new album stands up to the ones that you did back in the 60s?
I think it was done really similar, you know. We practiced, but we never tried to get go and be something we weren't, you know, like, and we've never tried to play something like jazz or something like that, because it just, Mick Jagger says it's only rock and roll, but we like it, you know.
The classic albums, let's say that the first two albums, Here Are the Sonics and Boom. Now, on those two, you've got a mixture of covers and of original tunes. And we listened to one of the covers, I Don't Need No Doctor, right before we started talking. That song was first done by Ray Charles. Why did you choose to cover I Don't Need No Doctor?
Well, I like the song. We all like the song. And we thought we could just kind of do it a little bit our way, our own way, and make it a Sonics traditional type of sound on it. And it just fit. It just fit in. It was a natural for us.
Yeah, I think so. It sounds great, Sonic-fied. And the first single from the album is Bad Betty. Oh, and you do a great vocal performance on there. What can you tell me about Betty? Is she a real person?
Well, I have a lady friend whose name is Betty, but I think Betty can just be applied to just about anybody who's living in the fast lane, you know, doing crazy stuff.
Who was responsible for writing Bad Betty? Is that yourself, or was that Rob Lind?
Yeah, that was Rob and a friend of his.
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a listen to Bad Betty. That'll be our outgoing song. But first, Jerry, thank you one more time so much for speaking with me today as part of our Coolest Conversations.
Oh, you're welcome.
And let's take a listen now. This is Bad Betty from the Sonics in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Bad Betty on a Bonneville, yeah. She looks back when she's sitting still. High boots and looks
mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.